last speaker is Bill Eggington, who's professor of Spanish at Johns Hopkins. He's the author of a number of books, The Philosopher's Desire, not very relevant today, A Wrinkle in History, Perversity in Ethics. In fact, all of these seem relevant to all of the titles, if managed to be relevant. How the World Became a Stage, and also the editor of A Pragmatic Turn in Philosophy, is currently completing two books, The Theater of Truth on Ideology of the Baroque and Neo-Baroque Aesthetics, and Breaking the Code of Codes on Contemporary Fundamentalism. So perhaps you would lead us back to religion today. Bill Eggington.
Well, I don't know, David, if you were the aspirin, I guess that makes me the Alka-Seltzer or something like that. So I'll find the frosting
bubbly. Doesn't say very
bubbly.
Much about me.
Oh, you chose the metaphor. I add my thanks to the organizers. Richard, it's good to see you again, Jonathan as well. And it's the time since 2002 back in Buffalo when David and I and Martin were in the philosophical reading group at Buffalo. These were truly great intellectual times. I often think back on when writing today. And in fact, they've left an indelible mark. So this is a great opportunity to come back to some of those discussions. I really appreciate it. So, when it came to my attention that my daughter would eventually be one of her generation's great philosophers, she was 5 years old. She still is, in fact. This was only a couple of weeks ago. We were discussing my granting her permission to leave the table without having finished eating. And she lamented that if I didn't relent, she would, and I quote her, never get up from the table and never be able to watch television. When I answered a bit thoughtlessly that never is a very long time, she promptly responded, "No, Papa, never is not a long time. It's the opposite of time." She went to watch television. If I'm honest with myself, I probably have to admit that I didn't come to this insight until I was in my 30s and met that remarkable student who was never really a student of mine, Martin Hagen. We're all here for the same reason, so I won't fritter away my limited time with praise, faint or otherwise, and instead will take up the charge of critically engaging with Martin's ideas, a fruitful exercise that has repeatedly commanded my attention since the day he showed up in my seminar room six years ago. A brief note on contrary styles might be in order. Martin is, as I'm sure you're all aware, a consummate polemicist. Nothing gives him more pleasure, I speculate, or provides more to the philosophical reader than to slice and dice an unwitting opponent's arguments with the unyielding edge of his own private Occam's razor. I, on the contrary, being of a sedentary and kindly nature, tend to notice all of the sundry ways my erstwhile opponents are, in fact, making the same point I am, and thus only slightly nudged to see it as well. Perhaps unsurprisingly, we integrationists drive polemicists batty. For who can find it even passingly tolerable to engage in hard-fought critique of a colleague's core assumptions, only to have that colleague lift his head after a seeming eternity of listening and furiously scribbling notes to say, as legend has it that Slavoj Žižek once did to a very earnest proponent of post-colonial theory here at Cornell, "I totally agree." as you will see then, in much of what follows, it will seem that I'm cozying up to Martin's position even as he wards off my advances with his deadly razor. Thankfully, actual and identifiable differences do emerge, to which, aided by years of debating these with him in person and on paper, I will draw our attention as rapidly as possible. As our disagreements come into clearest contrast in the context of Martin's deconstructive critique of psychoanalysis, I'd like to begin my remarks by way of a response to his excellent chrono-libidinal reading essay. At the outset of that essay, Martin quotes Freud as saying, quote, "Transience value is scarcity value in time. Limitation in the possibility of an enjoyment raises the value of the enjoyment," end quote. And that's from what's the name of the essay?
On transience
that you quoted already, earlier today. He cites this passage to demonstrate that despite the theoretical failure Martin aims to demonstrate at the heart of psychoanalysis, Freud, in fact, has the conceptual tools at his disposal to think desire differently, and even intuits, although eventually eschewing, this correct interpretation. The false theory he ends up with is that fear of time stems from, quote, a metaphysical desire to transcend time, end quote. That's from Martin. Consequently, the correct theory that Freud intuits but ultimately rejects for this false theory is that, it, quote, it is because one desires a temporal being, chronophilia, that one fears losing it, chronophobia. Chronophobia is thus intrinsic to chronophilia, end quote. This last statement encapsulates the theory Martin now calls chronolibido. How do you pronounce it, actually? Chronolibido? Chronolibido? Did I stress it right?
English is not even my language.
Yeah, I know, but it's your turn. I mean, you have to know how to pronounce it, right? The theory of chronolibido proceeds from the premise that everything that can be desired, I'm quoting Martin right now, is temporal in its essence. Even the most intense enjoyment is haunted by the imminence of death, but without such finitude, there would be nothing to enjoy in the first place. The inherent finitude of life is not something that comes to inhibit desire, but precipitates desire in the first place, end quote. Incorrect theories of the relation between time and desire are theories that contradict this one, and psychoanalysis does so in two distinct ways. Quote, the first way consists in denying that chronophobia is intrinsic to chronophilia. The second, in denying that chronophilia is intrinsic to chronophobia, end quote. In other words, psychoanalysis is guilty of affirming both, that we can desire temporal things without that desire being entangled with a fear of their passing, and that our fear of the passing of things is independent from our desire of them as temporal things, stemming primarily not from their temporal nature, but from a metaphysical idea of permanence. Although the second of these two failings receives by far the lion's share of his attention, Martin starts out by showing how even the first makes a showing in the same essay of Freud's from which the above quotation was taken. In this case, he quotes Freud's assertion that there's no reason why, quote, the thought of the transience of beauty should interfere with our joy in it, end quote. Martin reads this statement as saying that, quote, if we affirm mortal life, we should be able to accept the death that is inherent in mortal life and free ourselves from the phobic relation to the passage of time, end quote, and proceeds to argue against this position that affirming, and this is Martin now, affirming mortal life does not entail accepting death. On the contrary, to affirm mortal life is to oppose death, to resist it and defer it as long as possible. But since mortal life is essentially linked to death, it is internally bound to what it opposes. This is why there can be no chronophilia without chronophobia. Due to a constitutive finitude, every affirmation is inhabited by negation from the start, and even the most active embrace of life cannot be immune from the reactive mourning of death, end quote. I must admit that it sounds to me like Freud is summarizing Martin's arguments, not contradicting it. If there's no reason that the thought of the transience of beauty should interfere with our enjoyment of it, is that not another way of saying that the enjoyment of beauty is in no way incompatible with the thought of its transience? Especially if we read this assertion in the context of the quotation from before that Martin cites approvingly, that, quote, limitation in the possibility of an enjoyment raises the value of the enjoyment. It seems quite clear that Freud is indeed positing something along the order of chronolibido. This idea was also developed by Freud in his study of sexual enjoyment and its relation to barriers of social opprobrium, as when he states in his three essays on the theory of sexuality that the, quote, sexual instinct in its strength enjoys overriding social barriers. Nevertheless, Martin insists that Freud's position here entails a denial of chronophobia through an impossible acceptance of death, and insists again against this, that Freud so construed that accepting death is actually impossible. No, excuse me. And insists against this, against Freud so construed that accepting death is actually impossible. That would be Martin's position. That there is no affirmation of life that does not entail a denial or deferral of death. Quote, to affirm mortal life is to oppose death, to resist it and defer it for as long as possible, end quote, Martin's position. This resistance to and deferral of death, what he calls survival, while not to be confused with an acceptance of death, is equally to be distinguished from a metaphysical desire to transcend time. And since much of the rest of Martin's essay is dedicated to demonstrating how psychoanalytic texts rehearse the second failing of treating fear of time as stemming from a desire for eternal ideas, his conclusion is that psychoanalysis as a theoretical corpus is caught on the horns, as it were, of a temporal dilemma. Asserting the possibility both of the acceptance of death in everyday life and the denial of death through fantasies of immortality. The theory of chronolibido, in contrast, is supposed to resolve this difficulty by affirming the aporia of time as the operative mechanism of all desire. We neither accept death in our enjoyment of life, nor does our desire stem from death-defying fantasies. Rather, chronophobia and chronophilia are two faces of the same coin. But what Martin reads as a contradiction, impossibility, aporia in psychoanalysis, was, I would argue, never not viewed as such, even if the subtle language of deconstruction is better at clarifying the double bind. When psychoanalysis speaks of mourning an object that was never there in the first place, or of desire being grounded in the lack of castration, these are moves within that language game akin to, I would argue, Martin's elegant formulation, there can be no chronophilia without chronophobia. Martin starts his attack on the second assumption of psychoanalysis, that chronophobia stems from metaphysical desire instead of from chronophilia, with the same text. This time it is a poet interlocutor of Freud who, quote, denies that his chronophobia stems from a chronophilia by asserting that the temporality of being is incompatible with the object of his desire, end quote. But again, in my reading of the same text, Freud appears sensitive to the poet's plight and to the contradiction of his discourse. That we experience contradictory desires is not only not alien to psychoanalysis, it might be called its core insight. The poet, then, is wrong in denying, if implicitly, the internal relation between his love of the timely and his fear of its demise, but he is right in doing both, loving what vanishes and fearing that it will vanish. To reiterate, and this is a claim that I work out in more detail in Perversity and Ethics, quote, limitation in the possibility of an enjoyment raises the value of the enjoyment. That, quote, is perhaps the essential formulation of the Freudian theory of drive or drivenness per se, according to which barriers to enjoyment are not secondary, but rather constitutive of the enjoyment that attainment or not of the object entails. Martin locates what he calls a striking example of Lacan's tendency to violate what we could call the second law of chronolibidinal reading in Seminar 11. And this is, I'm quoting here, Martin at length. Quote, where Lacan asserts that all objects of desire are representatives of an immortal life that is lost at birth, that's the one may certainly argue that Lacan does not actually believe that an immortal life has been lost, but only analyzes it as the fundamental fantasy of the subject. On this reading, Lacan grants that lost immortality is only a retrospective projection, that there never was a state of fullness, but nevertheless insists on our mourning of a thing we never had. However, even a consistent version of the latter reading does not answer my, Martin's, chronolibidinal critique, since it still assumes that the truth of desire is the lack of being. The moment of authenticity in Lacanian analysis is the moment when one recognizes the lack of being that nothing can fulfill and assumes the symbolic castration that constitutes one's subjectivity. The ontological lack, which entails that no object can be the desired thing, is the repressed truth of desire that psychoanalysis aims to elucidate. In contrast, still quoting Martin, chronolibidinal reading not only denies the existence of immortality, but also takes issue with the assumption that immortality has ever been the goal of desire. Rather, chronolibidinal reading seeks to demonstrate that the so-called desire for immortality dissimulates a desire for survival that precedes it and contradicts it from within. End quote. I take this extended passage as a fair and typical example of Martin's treatment of Lacan. It is both detailed and analytic, and yet to my mind it continues to exhibit certain fundamental inaccuracies. The most crucial point is that Martin fails to systematically distinguish between desire and drive. Indeed, this distinction has become the psychoanalytic name for the very distinction that Martin's theory both needs and disavows. Thus, when Martin writes that, quote, the moment of authenticity in Lacanian analysis is the moment when one recognizes the lack of being that nothing can fill and assumes the symbolic castration that constitutes one's subjectivity, repeating that quote, he's technically right. But at the same time, he seems to misunderstand the very nature of that move. For that moment of recognition is nothing other than the so-called traversing of the fantasy through which a subject moves from the logic of desire to the logic of drive. Quote, recognizing the lack of being that nothing can fill, and, quote, assuming symbolic castration, end quote, are not phrases that mean that the subject now orients himself around the negative version of eternity, fullness, or any such avatars of God. Rather, the recognition is of the fact that precisely such avatars are themselves lacking. In Lacanese, that there is no other of the other, or to the other. That our objects of desire are not partial representations of an ever-receding plenitude, but are simply partial, through and through. It is not ontological lack that is the repressed truth psychoanalysis aims to elucidate. Drive is the repressed truth of desire. And to my mind, Martin's notion of chronolibido has many more similarities than it does differences to the Lacanian notion of drive. Let me quote a recent text by Žižek that nicely articulates the distinction between desire and drive. Quote, it is wrong to claim that the pure death drive would have been the impossible total will to self-destruction, the ecstatic self-annihilation in which the subject would have rejoined the fullness of the maternal thing, but that this will is not realizable, that it gets blocked, stuck to a partial object. Such a notion retranslates the death drive into the terms of desire and its lost object. It is in desire that the positive object is a metonymic stand-in for the void of the impossible thing. It is in desire that the aspiration to fullness is transferred to partial objects. This is what Lacan called the metonymy of desire. We have to be very precise here if we are not to miss Lacan's point and thereby confuse desire and drive. Drive is not an infinite longing for the thing which gets fixated onto a partial object. Drive is this fixation itself in which resides the death dimension of every drive. End quote. Thus, when Martin complains that, quote, given that the death drive is originary, the life drive is explained away as a partial drive, end quote, this is also, in a sense, the reverse of the Lacanian position. For Lacan, real, actual drives are always partial. The death drive, which is not a drive toward death, but towards limits, towards excessive life, is the mythical extreme of drivenness per se. In a note to his article, Martin puts our differences into manageable perspective. So I want to quote that note, talking about my critique of Derrida and the philosopher's desire, he writes. Eggington reduces Derrida's critique of Lacan to the assumption that psychoanalysis believes that the lost object actually exists out there in the world somewhere or in our past, end quote. While Eggington rightly maintains that psychoanalysis does not have to subscribe to such a belief, but rather analyzes it as phantasmatic, he does not call into question that there is an operative desire for fullness. On the contrary, the philosopher's desire is for Eggington the desire for an impossible fullness that would, quote, and he's quoting me, iron away the difference from the self at the heart of any and all identity, end quote. Continuing, Eggington notes that deconstruction can be seen to question precisely this notion of desire, but instead of pursuing this point, I do pursue the point at quite some length later on, though, he assimilates Derrida's thinking of the double bind to Lacan's conception of desire. In contrast, I, now Martin, argue that the deconstructive thinking of the double bind allows for an account of desire that is fundamentally different from Lacan's. The point is not that desire strives for an impossible fullness, but rather that the so-called desire for fullness is contradicted from within and not operative in the first place, end quote. It is true that I do not call into question the operative desire for fullness, and Martin has here succinctly identified a crucial difference between our perspectives. It is also true that I do not find chronolibidinal desire, quote, fundamentally different from Lacan's notion. What I find in agreement with many contemporary readers of Lacan is that Lacan articulates two levels of desire after 1960, drive and desire as such. Philosophically speaking, psychoanalytic intervention undermines certain illusions, such as those of permanence, core self-identity, the metaphysical fantasies of desire, by bringing the subject to identify with his or her symptom, and an irreducible, this is the symptom, agglomeration of irreducibly partial drives that always fail to correspond to the corporate whole desire proffers as its end goal. Martin's claim, with Derrida, is that there is not and cannot be two levels of desire, the logic of the double bind being that desire is always both and at the same time driven by the subject's internal non-correspondence to itself, entrapped by the metaphysical tools it needs to analyze that desire, and that the two cannot be separated. But in that case, desire for fullness is in fact part of the subject's situation, despite the internal contradiction that both discourses agree are there. Martens and Derrida's claim to the contrary, that desire for fullness is not only illusory but also inoperative, is nowhere substantiated. And this, now I'm going to go back on certain points that were brought up in the first in the first session this morning. Who are we to say that illusory and impossible desires are for that reason ineffective? I would claim to the contrary, and this leads into the debate on theism and atheism, and thus has a bearing on the thesis of radical atheism, that a great many broadly institutionalized illusions are not only highly operative, but can be exceedingly dangerous as well. One reason my continuing debate on this issue is so helpful for me is that my current work involves identifying and providing a theory for fundamentalisms that are not obviously or exclusively religious. Martin would seem to claim on the one hand that such critique is unnecessary because desire cannot possibly be ruled by illusory goals, while at the same time arguing that a distinction and hence a critique is necessary to clarify deconstruction's opposition to philosophical discourses that ultimately buy into those very illusions he says cannot be operative. To quote Martin again, chronolibidinal reading seeks to demonstrate that the so-called desire for immortality dissimulates a desire for survival that precedes it and contradicts it from within, end quote. This is exactly right. And the psychoanalytic version is, psychoanalysis seeks to demonstrate the desire for immortality dissimulates the drive that precedes it and contradicts it from within. Even the last point, beautifully articulated, and yes, probably better than Lacan did, by Martin, is nevertheless essential to the Lacanian perspective. Drive powers desire while contradicting it from within. Thus, when I read Martin write about drive, I could swear I am reading the words of a sophisticated reader of Lacan. Quote, the reason why the drive keeps going is not because it fails to reach its proper destination, but because every destination is temporal in itself. The goal of the drive is not to come to an end, but to live on. The drive is neither aggressively oriented toward a lost thing nor progressively oriented towards an imagined fullness. From the beginning, the drive is driven to survive and thus to exceed any final repose. Whatever one is driven to, the drive produces an internal excitation that breaks the peace and resists the quietude of death, end quote. I cannot think of a contemporary self-identified Lacanian who would read that passage and think that it was written as a critique of Lacan. In contrast, when Martin writes, quote, for Lacan, the jouissance expected is not inaccessible for contingent reasons that can be overcome. On the contrary, it is inaccessible due to the ontological lack of being. Lacanian analysis therefore sets out to dispel the idea that full enjoyment can be obtained by the subject. By, quote, traversing the fantasy of full enjoyment, the analysand is supposed to arrive at the insight that nothing can satisfy his or her desire, that nothing can be it, and learn to live with the absence of the thing. End quote. When he says this, when he writes this, what he's describing is the experience of desire, which is indeed oriented around fantasies of fulfillment and total jouissance. Unlike desire, drives do attain jouissance. Traversing the fantasy designates the passing of a subject of desire, always expecting an attainment of plenitude, to the subject of drive that it always was, enjoying partiality as partiality. Finally, when Martin writes that the, quote, supposed experience of ontological lack, the lament over the absence of a timeless being, dissimulates the preceding attachment to a temporal being, end quote. Again, I think he gets it exactly right. But the dissimulation in question, the same dissimulation necessary for Martin's own understanding of what deconstruction undoes, is also the very dissimulation of drive by desire's eternal objects that psychoanalysis seeks to elucidate. The fact remains that Martin has done a good job finding inconsistencies in Lacan's writings, inconsistencies that would seem at times to contradict this reading. But in order to identify these inconsistencies, one must ignore a now canonically recognized progression in Lacan's thought and the development of a rigorous theoretical distinction between drive and desire not present prior to 1960 and only gradually articulated after that. At the end of his introduction to radical atheism, Martin describes his treatment of Derrida's oeuvre as analytical as opposed to exegetical, and refers to the concept he calls inheritance. Quote, by providing such an account, I seek to inherit Derrida in the precise sense that he is giving to the word, To inherit is not simply to accept what is handed down from the master, it is to reaffirm the legacy in order to make it live on in a different way. Such inheritance cannot be accomplished through pious conservation, but only through critical discrimination. One question that is bound to arise, then, is whether there are aspects of Derrida's work that do not adhere to the radically atheist logic I developed, especially since it stands in sharp contrast to the readings proposed by many other major interpreters. My response is that even if one is able to find passages in Derrida that cannot be salvaged by the logic of radical atheism, it is far from enough to refute the reading I propose here. Like everyone else, Derrida was certainly liable to be inconsistent. However, in order to turn these inconsistencies into an argument against the logic of radical atheism that I established, one has to show that they are not, in fact, inconsistencies, but rather testify to the operation in Derrida of a different logic altogether. End quote. Cannot the same be said of Lacan, then, and of my, and not only my, reading of him? In a similar vein, I would argue that the inconsistencies Martin and others have found in his work are far from enough to refute a reading that also testifies to a different logic in Lacan's thought, one that renders his thought more coherent than the readings his detractors present. Here, then, is the bone of my contention with Martin's argumentation. While his ontology of desire and our relation to time and loss is, in my view, absolutely correct, the fact that metaphysical desires or images of eternity are incoherent and even impossible does not mean that we don't desire them. And this, I'm just repeating Michael from this morning. I would even go so far as to say that Martin's own subtle argumentation always drives this point home. There can be no chronophilia without chronophobia. Well, chronophobia can and often does manifest itself in the form of delusions of permanence. As Martin writes in the chrono-libidinal reading essay, quote, the unconditional affirmation of survival is not a matter of choice that some people make and others do not. It is unconditional because everyone is engaged by it without exception. Whatever one may want or whatever one may do, one has to affirm survival because it opens the possibility to live on and thus to want something or do something in the first place. Even if I sacrifice my life for another, this act is still motivated by the desire for survival, since I would not do it. I would not do anything for the other if I did not desire the survival of him or her or it. The affirmation of survival is therefore not a value in itself. It is rather the unconditional condition of all values. Whatever one may posit as a value, one has to affirm survival, since without survival, the value could never live on and be posited as a value in the first place. Certainly, we can never accuse Martin of ambiguity. This is straightforward, strongly stated. But in what sense does this affirmation consist? If we are all affirming survival in some pre-theoretical sense, this cannot mean that we are all aware that we are doing so. If that were the case, then De Ultima, in Martin's reading of the Symposium, would have already figured this fact out and would not have had made the mistake of affirming immortality instead. And Martin would not have to have deployed his excellent arguments against her. To cite another example, Martin elsewhere quotes Derrida's impressive reading of Heidegger on the question of time, that there are not and never were two kinds of time, one original and one vulgar, secondary, that there has only ever been one metaphysical notion of time, and that every such instantiation has always held within it the tools to deconstruct that notion's pretensions. While Derrida's efforts are here directed at the infamous Heideggerian distinction, which will ultimately support the even more infamous Eigentlichkeit and Uneigentlichkeit distinction, he deploys the same structure to ward off all attempts to approximate Derrida's thought with that of Levinas, for whom the bare face of the other constitutes a kind of ethical ground zero or absolute negation of violence. For Derrida and Martin, in contrast, Levinas's theory deploys the same logic as the above-criticized distinctions, in that it proposes the face, in this case, as a more fundamental or authentic moment against which the inauthenticity of violence toward the other may be critiqued. Martin, to my mind, is utterly correct, then, in insisting on the distinction between Derrida's and Levinas's positions here. Just as any proffering of an authentic level of discourse, desire, reality, is always necessarily corrupted, inauthentic at its core, so is any encounter with otherness inhabited by a core violence that belies its value as an unproblematic seat of ethical action, of ethical relations. Where I differ is at the level of the distinction. To my mind, Derrida and Martin are posing their own version of the authentic-inauthentic distinction, already evident in Martin's title of that essay, The Necessity of Distinction. Naturally, they are much too smart to phrase this distinction in terms of authenticity, ownness, propriety, etc. In fact, the whole point is to distinguish between discourses that rely unproblematically on those distinctions and other, and another, the deconstructive one, which points that fact out. If it weren't for this second distinction, where would the difference lie between what Martin's arguments and those of his opponents? The answer is that deconstruction is different insofar as it points to the constitutive interrelation of purity and impurity, self and otherness, violence and peace, chronophilia and chronophobia, where other discourses fail to do so or even actively promote the illusion that unencumbered access to one pole is possible or desirable. Where I have differed from Martin is merely in my insistence that a sympathetic reading of Lacan and Freud, as well as of Heidegger, that's a different story, sees in their discourses as well the centrality of such mutual imprecation, even if the language they use to identify it is often clumsier than Derrida's. This debate plays itself out in Martin's book and thesis on atheism as well. Unlike common garden variety atheism, radical atheism does not merely posit the non-existence of God. Rather, radical atheism attacks the very desire underlying such positing. Not only is it incoherent to believe in God, it is incoherent and impossible to desire to believe in God. For such a desire undermines itself, the very basis of desire being temporality, decay, loss. Quote, in contrast, by developing the logic of radical atheism, I, Martin, argue that the so-called desire for immortality dissimulates, again, a desire for survival that precedes it and contradicts it from within. The key to radical atheism is what I analyze as the unconditional affirmation of survival. This affirmation is not a matter of choice that some people make and others do not. It is unconditional because everyone is engaged with it without exception. Whatever one may want or whatever one may do, one has to affirm the time of survival, since it opens the possibility to live on and thus to want something or to do something in the first place, end quote. As before, similar passage, the key here is the relation between dissimulation on the one hand and affirmation on the other. What does it mean to affirm without exception, even when that affirmation is dissimulated by another desire? The answer may have something to do with the notion of illusion and Martin's implicit rejection of what we could call certain limits of knowledge. For Martin, metaphysical illusions lack operativity. They must lack it, because what he calls the desire for survival precedes and contradicts them from within. But what is so difficult to accept about the operativity of illusions? Certainly anyone present today could offer countless empirical instances of illusory beliefs that have instigated human action. Martin's resistance therefore cannot be based on empirical evidence, but must be based on an a priori deduction. Desire for survival is another name in the realm of human life for spacing. The becoming space of time and the becoming time of space, which Derrida also calls différence. Against Kant, for whom time and space were a priori conditions of human sensibility but had no bearing on the noumenal realm, Martin claims for Derrida's concept of différence what he calls an ultra-transcendental status. We've been talking about this already in the second half today. In other words, it is not limited to the sensible realm. Quote, on the one hand, the spacing of time has an ultra-transcendental status because it is the condition for everything all the way up to and including the ideal itself. The spacing of time is the condition not only for everything that can be cognized and experienced, but also for everything that can be thought and desired. On the other hand, the spacing of time has an ultra-transcendental status because it is the condition for everything all the way down to the minimal forms of life. As Derrida maintains, there is no limit to the generality of différence, and the structure of the trace applies to all fields of the living, end quote. Martin's point is that spacing is not limited to sensibility, because everything is enabled by it, even the unchanging concepts and ideals Kant calls upon to stabilize and guarantee his theory of cognition. This is a good argument, and it's one that recalls Heidegger's reading in Kant in The Problem of Metaphysics, where he points out that even the concept temporalizes, forcing Kant to articulate the law of non-contradiction as A cannot be, and Heidegger emphasizes, at the same time, A and not A, and this is now Heidegger, where the at the same time expresses the temporal character which, as preliminary recognition or preparation, originally belongs to all identifications as such, end quote. But Kant is concerned not only with the stability of concepts, but also with the limits of the knowable. And here Martin's and Derrida's extension of the concept to a place without limits begins to create problems. There is some ambiguity here. On the one hand, Martin states that there is no limit to the generality of différence. On the other hand, he continues that thought by saying that the structure of the trace applies to all fields of the living. And I think Sam brought this up earlier before, and I think it's a valid question to talk about later. Furthermore, the example of an upper limit is provided by the ideals, which we could all grant are also human, and thus in its specific applicability, as the title of Martin's book suggests, spacing would seem to be an issue for the time of life. Nevertheless, the claims of atheism, radical or just plain old garden variety atheism, concern not merely human life, but all existence. So while this rhetorical gesture, while his rhetorical gestures in introducing spacing indicated adherence to life and human subjectivity, his claims concerning religious belief would make little sense if they were not generalizable to all existence. I suspect that it is in this insistence on saying something not merely about human subjectivity and its limits and about their subsequent influence on human desire, but on existence per se, that influences Martin in his resistance to allowing illusions their power. Martin's point, absolutely true and well taken, is that there is nothing we can sense or imagine, but also think or desire, that does not require the basic structure of spacing in order for us to sense, imagine, think, or desire. But while we cannot do any of these things without spacing, we can certainly posit, while spacing, unimaginable notions like eternal simultaneity. Take the following thought experiment, a real cartoon, you know, that's very, very simple, overly simplistic. In exhibit A, the world is exactly as Martin describes. Not only phenomena, but the world itself is governed by the logic of the trace. In exhibit B, we have a world in which beings like ourselves, who can only cognize in spatial and temporal terms, are moved in their limited selves across a vast, eternal, and permanent sort of landscape. Now, of course, we cannot imagine that landscape without spacing, for we are exactly like the creatures in question. Still, I submit that the distinction I'm describing, in some weird way, makes sense to you. However, given these two worlds, the creatures in question, in exhibits A and B, would never, under any imaginable circumstances, be able to ascertain which kind of a world they inhabited. When one tries to imagine such a world, words and images fail, of course. But an unthinkable referent can still be a referent. This is what Kant calls a limit concept, which is what he designates the noumenal to be. And when he's being consistent, he insists that it can only have a problematical as opposed to an assertorical significance. In my view, Martin's claim of an ultra-transcendental status for spacing ultimately commits his radical atheism to an assertion concerning the way things are in themselves as opposed to how they appear to us. My problem with this is with the presumption to grant ultra-transcendental status to a concept of any kind, which is, I'm sure, by the way, exactly why Derrida denies différence, the status of a concept. For Martin, in contrast, there is no question that humans can and should intuit the fundamental nature of spacing, and consequently, there is no question but that this insight, an example of an intellectual intuition par excellence, equally makes impossible the illusions we hold so dear. But while the psychoanalytic notion of drive also contradicts desires, illusions from within, psychoanalysis has never sought to say anything about how the world is in itself, and has limited itself instead to an exploration of human subjectivity, period. This, I would submit, accounts for the origin of the differences between Martin's position and my own. Martin's certainty concerning the ultra-transcendental nature of spacing, and hence of the desire for survival, makes the operativity of desire's illusions untenable, even in the face of empirical evidence of their operativity. My claim is more modest. Desire's illusions do fall apart. After sustaining us, inciting us, disappointing us, perhaps leading us into violence, delusion, or death. And as far as the human is concerned, the theory of drive or chronolibido is a good name for the internal incoherence that undermines these illusions. But to believe that their incoherence robs them of any influence in the world of human affairs, one has to have a faith in human reason unlimited by the sensible realm. Too reasonable. I do not believe Martin would accept this premise, but I believe his position entails it. My critique of fundamentalist thought focuses on its reliance on what I call the code of codes, the assumption not that there's a way the world is apart from appearances, but that the world in itself is already structured as a form of knowledge, that it can be read and ultimately known. I do not believe Martin's notion exhibits this attribute, because nothing about the notion of spacing suggests that it functions like an all-encompassing code. Indeed, as a principle of infinite divisibility and change, it does exactly the opposite. Ultimately, though, while I find Martin's assertions concerning the world plausible and even convincing, without drinking the Kool-Aid, I cannot ascribe to a radical atheism that must claim knowledge of the world in itself. but must limit myself to a more moderate agnosticism that can cohabitate with the moderately religious of any stripe in a society where religious toleration is guaranteed. To conclude, I am very sympathetic to the arguments of radical atheism, principally to the notion of autoimmunity, as undermining, quote, the religious conception of what is desirable, because mutability, corruptibility, and violability do not testify to a lack of being that we desire to overcome, but rather are essential to everything that is desired and cannot be removed, end quote. I love that. As a reading of Derrida's position on theism and atheism, I would venture the book is unimpeachable. I do find it deeply satisfying. I also find it deeply satisfying as an ethical, even though he backs away from this, if you will, treatise on the desirability of immortality, or the lack of desirability of immortality. My main objection, however, remains. If we are all already necessarily affirming survival over and against the desire for immortality, then why would we need such an elegantly argued and impassioned book? My answer, we do need such a book, just as we need Martin, because the illusions of metaphysical desire are powerful and hard to dispel. Thank you.
Martin responds, but let's we have time for a few questions before our break.
Henry.
Well, this question of whether Derrida is saying the same as Lacan is, of course, an old one.
Mm-hmm.
Lacan said this to Derrida himself.
Mm-hmm. Derrida didn't like that.
He didn't like that. You're trying to say what I've already said.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never found that, I think that there are many, many obviously parallels,
right.
But if it's the same, I doubt your version of it too. Specifically,
mm-hmm.
about the drive,
mm-hmm.
you say that it's the same as survival,
The way that Martin articulates survival. As that which
okay.
is dissimulated by.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, let me tell you, I don't think I've ever been able to fully plumb the depths of the notion of the drive in Lacan. But let me give you a couple of key impressions that I have. In Seminar 11, Lacan describes the drive as always circulating around the
void. Right.
Now, that seems to me a really constitutive image for the image of the drive. And you say the drive is satisfied with partial objects.
But it's sort of constantly satisfying.
And that's like the nice way of the attractive way of putting what Lacan doesn't put that way.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't say it's satisfied with this. He says it just circulates around the void and does it endlessly.
Mm-hmm.
The drive has no rise and fall. The
mm-hmm.
drive is
mm-hmm.
constant. It
mm-hmm.
just goes and goes and
mm-hmm.
goes. And Zizek develops this in terms of the notion of a kind of automaticity
mm-hmm.
of life. And I think, if I recall correctly, he uses the so-called Muslims of the concentration camps
mm-hmm.
As an example mm-hmm. of a reduction to pure drive.
Right.
And that would be the gentleman who mentioned the concentration camps before, that would be more like what he was talking
mm.
about. But that is not what what I take Martin to be talking about in
mm.
his exposition of survival.
Mm.
It seems to me to be a fundamentally different polarity,
mm.
even if there are certain, they can be tweaked
mm-hmm.
to sound the same. It seems to me that the polarity is quite different in
mm-hmm.
what Lacan is arguing. And it goes back, that's the persistence, even in the doctrine of the drive, it's the persistence of this relentless negativity of Lacan's, which in Lacan is tied to the desire for authenticity
mm-hmm.
in this modern sense, this confrontation with the most negative
yeah.
as being the authentic thing to do. I know you abandoned concept of authenticity after the 50s,
right.
but he still keeps arguing that way. He keeps talking that way. Yeah.
I don't really. I'm not going to deny that these readings are possible. That they're well substantiated. This is someone who, for the most part, I'll make this very, very quick, because this is a lot of obvious stuff that I'm saying. But the most part was speaking, and then everything, the words were taken down, edited, and then compiled over years and years, and then he has his écrit. And if you look at these, the 40, 50 years of production, there's contradictions left and right. I mean, Judith once put, whenever Lacan has one of these great negative pronouncements, there is no such thing as a sexual rapport and things like this, right? A woman does not exist. Who is he talking to? And then Judith points out, well, he's talking to himself from several years earlier. He's making an announcement that contradicts himself and saying, now I'm changing my teaching. And I definitely recognize that he doesn't have the kind of exquisite rigor and meticulous coherence that Derrida often has, despite the fact that even as Martin says in his reading, that people will also find inconsistencies in Derrida. How can you not? This is a lot of writing. But I still think that there is a distinction to be made between the two, and that when you work out a coherent distinction, trying to make philosophical sense of it, and then looking at what influences were on Lacan, what was he reading at the time when he started to make these distinctions, and something extremely formative was his translation of Heidegger and work on Heidegger towards the end of the 1950s, before he started making this distinction, for example, that then when you read into the 60s and into the 70s, he's working more and more on distinguishing and teasing out this notion of drive. And I'm not saying it's the same, but I'm saying it's a lot closer than what Martin gives his position credit for, because Martin is really focusing on desire, but that there's a dyad. There's two different things going on in desire and drive.
Well, just a quick point. I mean, one of the other things that interests me, and that I'd like to hear Martin at some point, you know, not in response necessarily, but I would love to hear what his response would be to this, is that, all right, we're talking about the 11th seminar here, and this is in 1964, and in talking about the drive, what comes up in connection with this is this little science fiction myth that Lacan concocts of the lamella, which is then also discussed in the contemporaneous écrit position of the unconscious, and that I don't think that Lacan's discussion of the real thing, das Ding, you know, can be viewed as at all indicating something that we could, you know, call immortality or fullness in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But apart from that, though, when he does talk about immortality in the 11th seminar,
mm-hmm.
as well as in this contemporaneous écrit, it appears in the guise of something horrible, something
mm-hmm.
absolutely
yeah.
terrifying that
mm-hmm.
you know that we want to recoil from, that we want to flee from, and that would smother
that's,
us.
That's
yes.
immortal in the sense that it's excessive, that it's sort of going on and
yes,
on.
Yes, but
not
it's indestructible
it's,
life
right.
in all of its thriving, obscene, oozing vitality.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
given this, then it makes Lacan very, he indicates that we have a profound ambivalence about immortality. We can, on the one hand, have fantasies about, you know, this immortal fullness, but at the same time, when actually confronted with
yeah.
it, it's
yeah.
something which we recoil in
horror
from.
Right.
And this is already foreshadowed in the 10th seminar by his notion of anxiety generated by
mm-hmm.
the lack of lack, etc. And so there, I think it makes it hard to pigeonhole him as a traditional atheist,
mm-hmm.
to play off his supposed traditional atheism in a sublimated metapsychological form with radical atheism.
Yes.
Okay, well, sorry.
That wasn't a question, I'm
no.
sorry.
15-minute break, and then reconvene to hear Mark's answers to all questions.